Welcome to this week's edition of Two Men in the Middle, where two men in the middle of the country pontificate about politics and current events. I'm Brandon Kinnig.
I'm Craig Huey.
So, Craig, this week, a lot to talk about on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, but we'll start off talking about H.R. 1, the For the People Act. There's been buzz about this going back to January, and really nothing has changed in terms of the political calculation, the trying to get to a filibuster-proof majority to pass that. We were never there. And that legislation was finally unveiled, allowed to proceed, and it ran full smack into Mitch McConnell and the Republicans on Capitol Hill.
Or I just like to call it, it ran into the process.
Yeah.
It ran into
the So nobody was surprised by that outcome, right?
No, I don't think so. I had a couple people who were hitting me up with what I thought about that, and it's like that it's an 800-page messaging bill. There really wasn't much in there that could be passed in the form that it's in. I equate this a lot to like the Green New Deal.
Yeah.
It did a good job of outlaying, I think, where the Democrats see how far federal expansion of voting rights should go. I think it did a good job of laying out, here's all of the areas that we want to impact, and here are our thoughts in those areas. But taking that as a blank piece of legislation and voting on it is almost impossible to do. It's just too big.
And again, so like, where was the strategy with this? Because all this did was it got everybody on the record, but we knew what the outcome was going to be. We knew what the vote total was going to be. So it doesn't get Democrats anywhere closer to advancing voting reform legislation. Now, you've had a couple of developments, right? And you have Manchin, who introduced his compromise proposal.
Is that the John Lewis Act, I think?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is the act which does a number of things. It doesn't include everything that H.R. 1 included, but I would argue that some of the difficult things, the things that I would have trouble supporting are left out. But he does include voter ID to placate the right side of the aisle, the Republicans. But there's a number of things, making Election Day a national holiday, having a 2-week period before
where
you can vote in advance across all 50 states, being able to expand mail-in balloting. And then also, there's a number of those provisions, which I think are very positive and should garner support, but you're still in the same situation that you were before, right? Because what Republicans are going to come across the aisle and support that? This entire process, you've only had one Republican, that was Lisa Murkowski, who hinted at...
She was lukewarm.
Lukewarm,
at best.
Possible support, but that was it. So even from Manchin's standpoint, again, this should be kind of a wake-up call to Manchin that without filibuster reform, even this type of proposal is dead on arrival. And you knew that because, well, Stacey Abrams came out right away and supported it, but Mitch McConnell also immediately came out and cast dispersions on it and said it wasn't going to go anywhere.
And where it got killed is in the filibuster. The Republicans filibustered the bill. Even if they wouldn't have done that, it would have taken 60 votes to pass this thing. And I don't think there's 50 Democrat votes for all of it. No way.
But that's what I'm saying, even for Manchin's compromise legislation, which has, I think,
You still
got to get to 60 under the current rules, and there's no way you do that. Even if you picked off a couple of Republicans, you're still short. So we always keep coming back to this, I think. And again, we get lost in this, I think, minutia of, you know, do you kill the filibuster? But at the end of the day, just looking at it from the standpoint of reforming the filibuster or going back to old school rules around the filibuster to force senators to actually play their hand and debate continuously would provide an outlet for something like this to come to the floor, because that's the problem right now. It's the threat of filibuster that kills everything. There really is no use of the filibuster. It's the mere threat that stops and halts legislation.
And this is where we're playing two games at the same time. One, we're playing this filibuster and vote game.
Yeah.
That how do we move this forward? And if we can move it forward, would there be a path to get to 60 votes on this piece of legislation? So that's happening.
Right.
The other side of this game that we're kind of playing is this bill, if passed in its original form, would fundamentally alter how we elect people in the United States. Where's that conversation? When the Democrats are at their shadiest, It's when they try something like this, where they stack an 800-page bill. Let's talk about some things that are in this bill.
Well, and for number one, federalizing elections completely, right? Putting the federal government in control.
That's a big one.
And that's not one to overlook, right? Because our saving grace this last election cycle in 2020 was having 50 different state elections with 50 different processes and secretaries of states. Because if we did not have that and we had President Trump, he could easily use the apparatus of the federal government to keep himself in power.
And if this was a good faith, honest, intellectual discussion about our election system, that's where we would start.
Yeah.
We would start with what would happen
unintended consequences.
If Donald Trump could have grabbed a hold centrally, federally, of the election apparatus, where would we be?
Right.
Anything that starts with moving the running of an election from state to federal must start there. There's some other things in this bill. I was texting back and forth with a buddy this week and said, as a lifelong Democrat, if I were the Democratic senator from Missouri, count me as a no on this bill. There's some things in here that, number one, I don't think people realize how radically they change the election. And number two, I don't think there's any way they survive a court challenge. And a couple of them real quick. Number one, this bill kind of nationally institutionalizes ballot harvesting. This is where members of the party go out and collect ballots from people and bring them back to the polling place.
And we know that that is prone to abuse,
yes.
Right? And you don't have to go back very far. You go back a couple years ago.
North Carolina congressional
campaign that utilized a political operative who directly engaged in that and fraud. And he was actually tried and convicted for that. And they actually had a new election because that election was tainted. You go back several years prior to that to the 2004 to 2008 presidential cycles. Do you remember Acorn, that organization, which got in trouble for ballot harvesting? So that is a legitimate and valid concern.
Yeah. I'm not saying ballot harvesting could never work.
Right. And it does work.
I'm just saying we got to put some thought into that
one.
You have
to put guardrails around it because it is prone and can be liable to abuse.
So if two rational, reasonable Democrat and Republican, I'm going to play the rational Democrat, you play the rational Republican together.
Yeah.
I would say, or you would probably say, okay, can you live if we took this ballot harvest thing out? Yeah,
absolutely.
I can. Let's take that one out. Secondly, this would make all elections, I believe, publicly funded.
Yes, that's the public financing side of that.
This is a fundamental change to how we are doing campaign finance. I believe, for this change. But I'm going to need a couple weeks of really good, solid debate for us to run
this
to ground.
Shouldn't that be debated as a standalone bill? That's so enormous on its own.
Gigantic changes that would fundamentally change the way we select candidates and candidates execute a campaign and how we collect ballots that are just two parts of this giant 800-page bill.
Right.
There's no – those two come out. We debate those separately. Here's one that you'll – I know this is a hot button issue for Mike, and you might agree with this, but this makes giving anonymous donations illegal. I have a big problem with that.
Oh, I didn't realize it completely. Amount.
I'm pretty sure this is dark money clause.
Okay,
where it's going to be very much more difficult to give an anonymous donation, if impossible, to a political candidate. If I want to donate $500 to the Donald Trump Make America Great Again Fund, that is nobody's business except mine. And I do not want to create a situation where we weaponize political donations. You see that already with how all this is impacting corporate America. I think that could be a lever point that could make it even worse.
Yeah, and it really depends, because if you're donating to the candidate directly, that has to be disclosed if it's over a certain amount, and I think it's something like $50 or $100. But it comes into play when you're donating to PACs.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this makes PACs. You cannot anonymously donate to a PAC.
Well, and that would make the whole idea of a PAC null and void, right? Because that's the selling point of a PAC.
It gets rid of dark money.
Right.
But again, the court has seen that as a free speech issue. I kind of agree with that. If I want to donate to a political candidate, whose business is it of anybody but my own?
Right. Well, and regardless, those need to be debated separately. And that's the problem with this bill. They tried to pack so much in. And really, the priority should be, and if you're looking at what's happening around the country and state legislatures, priority should be just solely on expanding access to the ballot, ensuring that, you know, there's still the ability to do advanced ballot, mail ballots, providing extended periods of time to vote, that type of thing. And what Manchin included, which I don't think was included in the original For the People's Act, but making Election Day a national holiday, which I think makes plenty of sense. And the rest of the Western world, Europe, Australia, Japan, it is a national holiday. Like, we are an outlier in the fact that we don't have Election Day as a national holiday or on a Sunday, because every other Western country either has it on a weekend or it's a national holiday.
And I've heard that bills are written for three purposes, and your experience on the Hill, I'm guessing you can validate this. Number one, bills are written sheerly for messaging purposes.
Oh, yeah. Do you know how much time typically they will take just to come up with a catchy name that can be used as an acronym that's memorable?
I assume you've got some marketing firm you're paying big dollars to come up with that.
And that is a key part of writing legislation, the time that they spent on the title.
So we all can acknowledge that there are bills written, never intended to pass. They are there to message the way a party wants to move forward. That's one way to write a bill.
Right.
Another way to write a bill is for sheer partisan support and passing it sheer partisan line. You don't care about what the other side, you know, you're going to pass this, or you've got the votes to pass this in a partisan fashion. Therefore, you write it to only appeal to your side. And the third is you write a piece of bipartisanship legislation that can garner votes from both sides.
Exactly.
So I leave it to the audience. Look at the 800 pages of SR1. You tell me what category that falls into.
Yeah.
And my point is, I've had some people reach out to me and get pissed because that didn't pass, or that the pub shot down. Who cares? It was never going to pass anyway.
No.
It was there to put certain
because
topics on the table.
Because it became a wish list and grab bag of everything the Democrats wanted. And that's the frustration I have as a Biden Republican, is that there are legitimate and valid concerns about...
That is the first time I've heard you say that. Did that feel natural? Did that feel normal? Did that feel good?
It did, yeah. At this point, it does, yeah. So
it's better than saying I'm a Trump Republican.
Right. But for me, I see the valid concerns and the threat against voting that exists, and the tendency to try to peel that back. And so I think Democrats have a very limited window to tackle that. And you tackle that narrowly, but effectively and strategically, you know, and that, you know, with precision. And the fact that they just threw this grab bag bill together is frustrating, because what's going to happen is nothing will be passed. This is going to make their jobs much more difficult. They will have no plan. And then they're going to be scrambling to react to this when, again, from a messaging standpoint, it's a complete missed opportunity.
Well, and how this is supposed to work is, now as a Democrat, I punt my position to what Manchin's supporting, this John Lewis voting rights bill, which just has some basic fundamental common sense changes in it. And thank God now, as a Democrat, I'm allowed to say that people should show an ID to vote. That's pretty simple and straightforward. Glad to see that suddenly, I guess because Abrams said she agreed with Manchin, that now suddenly that piece of common sense is fine to say out loud.
But and that's an example of something that has long had support across the aisle by the American public, but in the political polarized frenzy that we're in now, by expanding access to the ballot, somehow that made it that you had to then diametrically oppose voter IDs. They had to be mutually exclusive, which I never understood. Like, those are not mutually exclusive. You can support voter ID and support expanded access to the ballot.
And if you didn't have to show your ID to function in normal day-to-day life, you would have an argument that an ID shouldn't be. But by the fact that you have to show an ID for multiple things,
to pick up a prescription, to get on a plane, I mean, it
never
less goes on
sense.
And on. And Manchin's bill actually made it easier, because he said you could use a utility bill as ID.
Sure. I mean, this is how it's supposed to work. Brandon, as the Democrat, I lay out this big, massive SR1 to use as Republicans, and you laugh at me and say, there's no way, there's nothing here I can vote if this isn't serious.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I know. We just kind of did this because this is one of the topics we're pushing on. Brandon, what can you not live with? And you say, you got to take this, this, and this out. And I'm like, okay, cool. But then you got to give me this, this, and this. And eventually we hit something we can vote on.
Exactly.
That's how this is supposed to work. It's okay for the Democrats or the Republicans to put out those big, giant messaging bills. The Green New Deal was a messaging document.
That's all that was.
It wasn't a piece of legislation. Where this breaks down now is there's not the process to say, okay, we can't even debate that giant thing. What three things do you really want out of this? Let's see if we can pick those up and form some type of legislation out of it.
Yeah, I mean, that debate was just stopped dead on arrival, and that's the problem with this.
If you're a Democrat and you're mad that this didn't pass through, didn't go through, you're not being intellectually honest with yourself.
You have nobody to blame but yourselves for the way that this was handled.
The bill was crappily written. It crammed way too much into a single bill. It was a messaging wish list. It didn't go through. That was to be expected. Pick up Manchin's bill, see if you can pick up some steam and go from there.
That's the way to go.
That's how I do it.
So in a similar vein on the legislative front, there was a piece of legislation today that there was a breakthrough on. Unlike H.R. 1 with the infrastructure bill, there appears to be progress and compromise now. So President Biden announced that five Democrats, five Republicans are on board with this $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that includes $559 billion in new spending.
Yeah.
So this is a major accomplishment. We have not had an infrastructure bill in this country in over 15 years. I can't even remember the last time. I mean, I've heard about them
a lot, but I've never seen one.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been back when I was K through 12 kid. That's apparently.
So, I was in college then, Brandon. So.
Oh, okay. Not to make you feel older or anything.
Brandon had to quickly acknowledge, hey, sorry for that, but go
sorry
ahead.
For
I'm
that.
Sorry.
Not unintentional.
That's not your fault. You can't keep those.
But our infrastructure is crumbling too in many parts of this country. Like, it's something that we haven't tackled. And so and this is legislation that also can have bipartisan support when done right. So there's a lot to be proud of. So it'll be interesting to see. I know this is all preliminary and this is as of just today.
Did they lay out the fee or the tax structure? Have we gotten that deep into this yet?
Not yet. Okay, so we haven't seen that one. And I'm curious to see that, right? Because there's been a number of proposed fees. I mean, there's been, you know, higher taxes on the rich. There's been the vehicle tax that's been bandied about, increasing the gas taxes, all of that. And the problem is, I mean, none of those are going to generate any type of support among the American people. No. There's widespread opposition to like a user fee or vehicle fee or increase in the gas tax.
So number one, Biden, take the win.
Yeah.
You came out with 2.6 trillion or whatever. That was never going to happen. That was your opening shot. You've negotiated to a pretty good spot. This is a lot of what the Republicans want, where it focuses on bridge, tunnels, roadways, stuff that people can see, which, by the way, you've got a midterm coming up in under 2 years. If people see a lot of shovel-ready projects that got off the ground and people working, that's going to be a big win for you. Joe, take the win.
He also has a limited window because we have elections next year. Democrats could lose the House, and then there will be no possibility of legislation moving through.
And the reason I say this is because Biden came out and basically said he's not forgetting all of the social stuff and all of the kind of softer infrastructure things that were in that original larger bill. He just wants that passed separately, but he wants them both on his desk at the same time. And he wants them both on his desk at the same time by the end of September when the session ends so that he can sign these. Joe, just sign what you get and use the power of the presidency to try to bully people into the other one.
That's right. That's how you take the win.
This is the compromise.
And not only that, it is so difficult to get anything passed in this environment. The fact that this is happening is incredible. Take it and then go back and fight for more later. But don't, you know, let the perfect be the enemy of good here.
Well, and his whole shtick was, I want to show you that government can have a positive impact in your life. Government can work. This is part of it. We've been after this bill for 50 years.
Right.
Sign the bill. If it's put to your desk, if that 980 or 1.2 trillion, whatever it was, when it comes across, sign that thing.
And I can't imagine he would not. That just would be political suicide.
Do you think there's 10 Republicans for this?
I wonder. I don't know. You know, it's interesting. There's a handful of Republicans who have expressed potential support, even like Jerry Moran of Kansas.
Yeah.
But again, that was before we had a actual bill with a price tag attached to it. So it's difficult to know because all of the, you know, soft support so far has been without an actual bill.
Is Mitch McConnell happy tonight about this, you think?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that his plan is to block as much as possible, and that's how he sees his role. So, you know, but the fact of the matter is that if this develops the way we see it developing and there is Republican support there, you know, it's just going to be an issue where, you know, he's lacks control one of the few occasions.
Bill Clinton was a master at this. You take part of your opponent's agenda, you reach over to their side of the fence, you draw a moat around it, and you own that issue.
You know what that's called? There's a really good word for it.
There's an actual phrase. What is it?
Triangulation.
Okay, so we're going to triangulate this issue away from
it's
you.
It's where you take part of your opponent's issue, and then you just basically take the rug out from under them, and they have nowhere to stand, and you look all the better for it.
Clinton did this with his sister soldier moment. He let you know I'm a different type of Democrat by saying to the black community, hey, you need to start taking more responsibility for your outcomes.
Well, that whole era, and if I ever get around to writing a book, I'll write an era about a book about the 90s, because that was all about triangulation. So that was where you had these wave of center-left, centrist Democrats that were elected, like Bill Clinton, like Tony Blair in the UK. You had others in Europe as well. And they all adopted that model and realized that they had to change, and they had to be pragmatic if they were going to be successful. And it was a whole different time and place from where we are today, where it's all about playing to your base and polarization. But it was effective, and it was effective not only politically, but also domestically and economically.
Well, when we say somebody's a good politician, this is what we mean.
Yeah.
They understand that this can be very powerful to triangulate on somebody else's issue, and it puts me in a totally different category.
And politicians that engage in that triangulation, they were called the third way. That's where the term the third way Democrat came about, and third way politicians at the time.
You were neck deep in Republican politics at that time, I'm assuming, when Clinton pulled that. That had to take the Republicans completely off guard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. And it was one of those kind of watershed moments where there was a lot of infighting in the party, and they never really fully recovered after that. So
that's what I'd like to see Biden do here. Triangulate on infrastructure. Make this your issue. Own this issue. Drive this to a conclusion. Put the Republicans back on their heels. You could probably get five more to join this initial group of five. So you've got a clear path to passing this. Take the win and start promoting yourself as somebody who knows how to get stuff done.
Exactly. That would be the good way to go.
If he does not sign that bill because he's afraid that the second bill won't get here, that is an absolute mistake.
Yeah.
And it's a mistake.
Without a doubt.
And I'm hoping Biden's to experience, and the team around him is to experience, to let that happen.
Agreed.
Do you see the New York City race Tuesday?
Yes. Mayor? So I was following that. So, interestingly enough, Andrew Wang dropped out immediately.
Yeah.
What was interesting is how quickly things can change in a race like that, right? Because when that race started, he was the front runner, and then he went to, you know, not being able to pull enough to come out ahead. Have they provided a timeline for when those ballots are going to be counted? I haven't heard that.
I've heard up to 4 weeks.
Wow.
Is how long this is going to take. And when you go, somebody on the Bulwark I was listening to the other day actually went through the process of how votes go up and down during ranked choice. And it is complicated, but it's not like there's not a dozen computer programs that could do this in seconds.
No, they could. And for those listeners that don't know what happens if, like, for example, and I think we listen to the same podcast, but if you have eight candidates running and you start tallying the votes, so the eighth candidate drops off and you look at their second choice, and then those votes get allocated, and then you go to see if anybody is over 50. If nobody's over 50%, you go to the seventh candidate, look at their second choice, sixth candidate, all the way on up. And then if you still don't have anybody over 50%, then you go back to the eighth candidate and you look at their third choice. Allocate those votes appropriately, then go to the next candidate up, seventh, look at their third choice, and so on. And you keep doing that until you arrive at 50%.
So this, in some ways, feels like a huge loss for progressives. If I'm going to put Andrew Yang in the category of being a progressive candidate.
Yang was such a promising politician. Do you think this ends his career, or does he continue to try for something else later?
If I'm the consultant, I look at Yang and say, you couldn't win in New York City.
Yeah.
Point me to the district you can. Because I don't, maybe a congressional seat, but that's not what you're interested in.
Right.
I just don't see where, if you can't win with a progressive message in New York City, and I think Yang and the gal Maya, I can't think of her last name, the one AOC endorsed.
I know who you're talking about,
which they don't think she's going to win either.
No.
If a progressive can't win the mayor of New what can they win?
Agreed. Although I would say Yang was progressive, but he was also like not doctrinaire liberal. He was more indoctrinaire.
Sure.
He had some kind of creative positions on a number of issues. He did engender some criticism too from the traditional progressive base for not, I think, you know, adhering to the party line enough in some areas. So, so he's kind of unique in that regard. But I do agree on the whole. It's interesting that in a city like New York City, the progressives did not seem to come out on top. And it looks like the eventual winner is going to be a moderate former
police officer. Adam. I can't think of his name.
Adam Carter?
That sounds close.
Okay.
But, I mean, this guy is not a talented politician by any stretch of the imagination.
I think he's the Brooklyn Borough president, if I have that right.
He has given some bizarre answers to questions.
Yeah.
But the question that he has consistently nailed is, I am not a defund the police person. I believe in police presence within the city. And I'm going to put an end to all of this defund talk. And we may do some reform, but we are not going to gut the police department.
By the way, it's Eric Adams.
Okay.
I was a little off there. Yes. But you're right. And so he is more traditional in that regard, but he's also aligned with New Yorkers in terms of their priorities, because the polling has shown that New Yorkers are concerned about rising crime, and that's a big issue in the city. And so, I think it's interesting. Somebody like him will likely come out on top.
And he really was a one-issue candidate, crime. Yeah. I mean, he had one thing going for him. I'm a cop. I know how the police department works. I can do something about crime. And he stuck in that area, and he just stayed on that talking point over and over and over.
And what's interesting is you really only had, I think, a couple of candidates in the eight-person field. The candidate that AOC was backing, and I think maybe one other, so maybe two out of the eight, who were defund the police and super aggressive about that. The others were not, which also tells you, I think, kind of where the writing on the wall is in terms of how candidates are kind of seeing, hey, we need to be careful about this because this is not...
The quicker we flush that out of our system,
the better.
It was dumb to begin with, especially in a city like New York City,
right,
that is so different, is so condensed. A police presence there is something that goes along with just having a city of that size.
The population density of New York is unparalleled for a city that size.
I still haven't heard somebody say, if not the police, then what?
Right.
I've heard ideas about sending people to who have mental health training. I know Denver, I think, is doing some case studies in that, but I have not heard any other plan that if New York City under de Blasio took $1 billion out of the New York City police budget, that might be appropriate.
Yeah. But, and I think there could be use cases where you take portions of funding out and redirect them other parts of the community that would maybe alleviate the burden on police to be responders to mental health situations or social situations, which are not part of their job description. Because there is a valid argument there, which we've said all along, that police become the catch-all for all of these situations that they're not really equipped to handle. And so we really need to all have this division of where police are involved and where they're not when it comes to some of these special situations. And some cities have started to do that. Mental health co-responders that accompany police or respond immediately to particular calls and then only bring in police if necessary. But there's a methodology there to look at. And again, it's not as simplistic. And that's the problem with the whole defund the police argument, right? That's a dead stop. That's never going to go anywhere.
I mean, It's true that crime is going up.
Yeah.
Is crime going up because of changing police policies? I don't know. It could be. I listen to a ton of conservative podcast and media. All of them have just absolutely zeroed in that it's police morality, or I'm sorry, the morale of the police department right now. It's the orders from on top that somehow the police are being reined in. They're being told, I guess, to ignore or not to engage in crime. I know there's a lot of cities that have said some low-level crime they're kicking out. One theory I've heard is that has an impact on the police that causes confusion. They don't know what their job is. And because of that, they are not engaging in the same level of policing that they did before.
That could be partially
true. Is that true?
But the problem I have with that and with conservatives making these broad brush arguments is that all policing is localized.
Yes.
So there is no, and we're not even talking about at the state or county level. It's at the city, town, municipal level. And so to make that type of broad brush, because I think you probably have some cities and towns where you have governing bodies that have said we're going to put more restrictions on police or on use of force or on what they're going to enforce as far as the law. But you have others that have not done that. So you have this patchwork, really, right? And so it becomes really difficult to tell unless you're looking at a specific community and you're looking at when policies change and comparing that to crime rates. So that's the only way you can really tell.
It seems like, to your point, it takes a lot of data to make to draw
this
that
conclusion.
This is a
data-driven argument, and it's being made without the data.
We don't have the data for that. It sounds logical, and I'm sure there's a part to it, but Do murders not happen because murderers see police? Well, this is what I don't get.
That argument is invalid, too, because the homicide rate nationally started going up last year, actually even before the George Floyd incident happened. So it was interesting because we were in the middle of a pandemic and on lockdown, but crime had already started increasing. So you saw this trend occur before you saw the expanded awareness of police brutality and the calls for reform. So again, I don't think you can say it's a direct causal effect because, this started earlier.
And what's the new mayor of New York going to do?
Yeah.
Start throwing people on walls again? Is he going to start putting quotas on police for a small arrest for mostly lifestyle crimes like public drunkenness, loitering? That's how we got here in the first place. So is the answer we just start going back to that again? I mean, I heard people on Fox News talk about, hell yeah, the next mayor of New York should just throw up roadblocks and just pull everybody over, frisk everybody for guns, weapons. Is that the answer? I mean, I am not quite old enough to remember the crime of the 70s.
Yeah.
But anytime you listen to somebody who was an adult in that era. In New York and really across the country, they talk about crime was a massive problem. I think you and I, for the most of our lives, we just haven't had to deal with high-level crime in any way, shape, or form.
Because
so this is a little bit new.
And crime started falling dramatically in the mid to late 90s across much of the country and has remained at those levels for so long. So this is a new phenomenon for many of us, seeing increasing crime, because it's not something many of us have seen in our lifetimes.
If you do some basic Googling on police research, research into what makes effective policing, you quickly find that there's not a lot of academic study in this area.
And how come we're not looking, and this is what gets me, is we're so parochial with this. We're not looking outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly,
that's a good point.
European countries, Australia, Japan, they don't have the problems we have with police brutality and accusations of it, but they still have effective policing and they still have low crime. So what are they doing differently that we're not doing?
Yeah.
Why don't we look at them as examples?
Is this all just culture? I mean, do you mean to tell me that murders can go up 40 to 50% in a major city in the U.S. just because somebody doesn't see a police presence that they used to see? That something about that just doesn't connect right.
Well, no, and that relies on somehow believing that, these criminals, for the most part, are rational, and they are directly tying their activity to police presence or lack thereof, or to what's happening with the law. And I would argue, first, most criminals are not following, police reform legislation or even what's happening in their own communities.
No.
They don't follow that. They don't care. And so there really wouldn't be a correlation there, because they don't act rational in the first place. And so you're assuming that they're responding directly to what's happening at a legislative level or at a local level, when that's just not the case. They're irrational actors.
And one of the most famous police studies actually came out of Kansas City, and I think it was in the 1980 or 1981, where they took the Kansas City PD, they took three districts or three precincts, basically pulled all the cops off the streets in Precinct 1, did normal patrol in Precinct 2, flooded the zone in Precinct 3. There were no changes in criminal behavior.
Oh, wow.
The number, what the study found was the number of cops patrolling and being a presence on the street had absolutely nothing to do with the crime level. And I think there's some validity to that. What I don't get, and where I'm struggling with, is the broken window style of police. And that is basically you concentrate on lower level crimes, and basically that prevents the neighborhood from becoming crime ridden. It's called broken windows because the experiment was they parked a car in Brooklyn, they parked a car in Palo Alto, California. The car in Brooklyn got stripped immediately, torn all apart, that was expected. The car in Palo Alto sat for 3 weeks unmolested until they broke one of the windows. Once they broke one of the windows, within hours, car was stripped down just like the car in Brooklyn. Hmm. So the theory behind it is that low-level crime is what feeds kind of all crime in the area. And if you want to bring the overall rate of crime down, you concentrate in the broken areas space. And if you prevent that crime, other crime doesn't happen. That's the whole theory around broken windows and what they did at New York. So when the broken windows study came out, it also got coupled with a study that came out of New York of what people in New York thought of crime, because this was at a time where major crime and violent crime is just falling like a rock. So the people who commissioned the polling or the survey thought, we're going to get really great marks because it's going really good. It found they got low marks, and it wasn't about the murder in the neighborhood or the sexual assault. It was, there's a drunk guy on the train every damn day that just won't shut up. What are you going to do about that? There's three kids every night smoke at a light on the corner by my store. What are you going to do about that? And it's when those two kind of studies and information fused together in New York, that's how they came up with this style of policing, where they came up with these special units, where they started putting people on walls. That's where that comes from. If we're not going to use those two things as a basis for forming kind of an ideology for policing, then what are we going to use?
Right.
And I still haven't heard anybody say, what is it then?
No, there hasn't been any alternative really put forward to that. Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, Biden today made a big deal. I think today or yesterday they signed some executive order about guns and going after federal gun dealers, like licensed dealers, but sell guns incorrectly or something. That's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
That's not going to have any impact on crime in any of these cities. I don't believe.
No. I mean, there's a number of, bills out there percolating that I think will hit at the margins, but they're not going to change things substantially. So yeah, it's interesting because that type of research is something like, has that even been revisited? Have there been any follow-up?
This summer I read I Can't Breathe by Matt Taibbi, and I would recommend that book to anybody that can hear me. It is all about the New York City Police Department, and it's about the death of Eric Garner. Eric Garner was the African-American gentleman who, horrible video where he gets choked out. And all Eric Garner did was basically sell illegal cigarettes.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
There's a cigarette tax in New York that's like 10 bucks a carton or something. They'd go down to Virginia or wherever. They'd buy cigarettes. They take them out of the package and they sell them loose for like a buck each or something. That was the great crime that he was doing. But it fits that type of lifestyle crime. Why is that guy standing on my corner where I'm trying to do my business or where I have to take my kids to the store selling cigarettes? I don't want to see that every day. Get that guy off the street. That's kind of the mentality that's
led to a lot of this. Well, it also plays in the psyche, American psyche, that we saw this play out over last year, especially when everybody was inside. All of these Karens that were calling the police on various people. Oh, look, here's a black family, you know, doing a barbecue. I don't know if they belong here. Or look, there's a black man that just entered my apartment building. Yep. I haven't seen him before. I don't think he belongs here. So this tendency to see something and think it's out of place and immediately resort to calling the police to handle it, which is an immediate escalation, by the way.
Absolutely.
And then 9 times out of 10 of these stories that we saw, these were people that were at the places that they lived, that they worked, that they played. They had every business being where they were, but it was just somebody that felt uncomfortable because they felt like that person shouldn't be there, and it was a change from what that person expected, and so they felt compelled to get the police involved.
And this is where, for conservatives, I yield to all of your arguments that black and brown people, we're talking about New York City, black and brown people commit most street crime in New York. That's just numbers. There's no way around that. If you're going to arrest criminals in New York City, you're going to arrest disproportionately people that are not white.
You do
because
have
that's the crime number.
Right. You do have the issue outside of like street crime, for example, when you're talking about just like possession, right? The whole disparity between like crack cocaine and powder cocaine.
Yes.
So you have lower income African Americans who get longer sentences for crack cocaine than a white person with the same amount of cocaine but in powder form.
I think this is more subtle than that. It's how these crimes are dealt with by the police officer in the community. If my kids were standing in a neighborhood somewhere they weren't supposed to be, the police are not going to go there, throw them on the ground, frisk them, cuff them, things like that. That's not going to happen.
There isn't
going
to be that type of aggressive posture towards them. Yeah.
There's got to be some leveling where, yes, the community expectations are that we can't allow low-level street crime to be in people's neighborhoods. It impacts the value of their property. It impacts the quality of life. We all recognize that, and it should be done. At the same time, the answer isn't creating specific units that go around 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day, put people up against walls and push them. In that book, one guy from Eric Garner's neighborhood basically says, 6 times a month, I get frisked. He's like, that's my average. And I don't mean a pat down. I mean, like you see in the movies, hands on a wall, legs spread, they pat you fully down.
Wow.
We'll pivot off this topic with this. The police in New York in the 90s had a term called socially raping a young man. And what they would do is they would put him up against the wall in his neighborhood, and they basically would depants him during their search. They would perform a cavity search in the street on this person.
I remember hearing about that.
In their neighborhood.
I can't believe that. Yeah.
That's what we're talking. There's got to be a balance we can find.
Absolutely.
That we don't allow the broken window stuff to happen, but we also treat people like human beings.
Right.
And we recognize what these crimes are, and there's got to be a better way to deal with them.
And there is a complete difference in treatment, and I've recognized that. I've read and seen these stories and seen them play out on video. And I remember it was some months back. I was pulled over for going through a stop sign in Mission Hills. So a police officer pulled me over. He was very nice, very respectful. And I was fumbling trying to find my insurance card. And my insurance card that day had just expired. I had renewed it online and didn't have the new one. So I was
obviously a criminal.
Right. Well, I was trying to pull it up on the app, you know, and then like my password and username weren't working. I'm like, oh, the
now
one time I need
something
to use the app. But I think, no, this is the difference though. Like, he was super patient and waited on me. And then finally he's like, that's okay. I believe you have your insurance. I'm not going to pursue it, but here's the ticket, you know, go about your day. Like, he could have also added an infraction for lack of insurance, right? Because technically I didn't show it to him. So yeah, I was thankful for that. But at the same time, I recognized like, that probably wouldn't have gone the same way if I was black, you know, in Mission Hills.
So you
have to think about it from that perspective.
I've said this before, and I'm not saying this from a space of physical toughness. If a cop puts his hands on me, he has a problem, because whatever that interaction is, lawyers are going to be involved.
Yeah.
I can't imagine any behavior I would exhibit that would cause a police officer to put their hands on me.
Right.
And if they did, there would be a cop looks at me as a 51-year-old white guy and says, I've messed with this dude. I'm going to have some problems. That's what they don't see, I think, when they look at an 18-year-old black kid on the street.
No, and that I think that's a difference, and that's the problem. Yeah.
So how do you build a modern police force that, I mean, I understand the guy who had his barber shop where Eric Garner stood all day selling cigarettes. I don't want that guy out there.
Right.
That's not right. He's making it harder for me to do business. And he has a right, and he has law on his side. We should respect that. But at the same time, like, you're not a criminal because you were speeding and didn't have. He's selling loose cigarettes.
Right.
Let it go. But at the same time, there's so many sides to this. How do you pick what side you want to push on?
And what's considered proportionate response, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's right.
That's a good point.
The whole thing, you know, George Floyd, the reason the cops showed up was because of the possible counterfeit bill, right? That was the point, which again is a crime if that was true. But again, you know, should he have paid for it with his life? I mean, that's what happened. I mean, that's what the crazy
part. Should the business have to take that and let him steal?
No, but what I'm saying is that's a problem, though. There needs to be, and I think this is where we see this played out time and time again, is police are called to handle something, and, you know, there's an expectation of what's considered an appropriate response, and then you see that go way above and beyond and turn into something it shouldn't be in the first place. So how do you do that? Again, do we just need de-escalation training for police to a greater degree based on the situation? But the point is, they don't have this problem in every other country.
They don't.
So they must be doing something right that we're not doing.
Part of this is culturally.
Yeah.
Part of this is culturally how we see ourselves as Americans. This fact that I am this independent, you know, alone in the world, rugged individual. I do everything.
We're gonna do what we want.
That's right. I can do what I want. I think there's a much more of a natural kind of conflict.
We also like to look at other countries for what we could be doing better because
dumb,
we know
Brandon.
Everything. We're
are
the best
other
at everything.
Are there Americans in those other countries? Well, they're obviously not doing it right.
Yeah.
I mean, who I've heard nobody come up with a single even good idea about what we should do about police.
Yeah.
And to Democrats, be very careful, because law and order is one of those issues that if it gets away from you, and if you get the perception that you are not law and order, you're going to have a problem.
Well, I'd argue that that had a outsized impact 100%. On a lot of congressional races last year.
If and we I think, haven't learned that lesson by now, we got to learn it
races,
quick.
Yeah.
Because if we pull another defund the police shit, and miss another opportunity, that's not going to, that's not at all.
I do want to, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what happens in like 4 years? Because right now, all I've heard is recruiting to be a police officer has fallen to nothing. Yeah, nobody wants to do it. We all know people are retiring, they're quitting. What happens in 3 years when maybe the size of the Olathe Police Department is only 75% of what it should be because they simply can't find people to take the roles?
Right. And then, you know, you're talking about long wait times for calls. And so, and then that becomes an even
more
crucial political issue.
Would you vote for a tax to provide the police with more equipment right now?
I mean, I would. I would consider it. I would.
I think you would. Do you think it would pass?
I don't know. Yeah.
You may be one of like 5% of people, I think, right now that would pull the trigger on that.
You know what's interesting is Shawnee is having a debate right now on funding for all aspects of city government. But one of the hardcore conservatives on the Shawnee City Council actually proposed having police pay for their own uniforms and not having the city pay for that, which is just incredible to me. Like, really? Like, at a time when we can't get police officers, you're going to have them?
Good thinking, sir. Just quickly, what does this gentleman do for a living?
Well,
or not. We could just skip right over that.
So there are two council members who are very much on this bandwagon. Both of them have worked for government. One worked a long time in state government. The other worked, was in the military and then was in FEMA for a long time during Hurricane Katrina. So I will let that speak for itself. But there's a, I'll just say there's a lot of hypocrisy, right? It's it's interesting to see people who are now on the city council who spent their lives working in government, and then they want to cut government to the bone.
Yeah.
You know, it's just something doesn't fly
could
there.
Could we have like civilian managers within the police?
Yeah, well, and so Shawnee actually established a civilian oversight body, and it's appointed members throughout the community to analyze when there's controversies or decisions and provide that.
There's some shit going down, and you're an active member of the police, and they say, Brandon, we need a civilian manager here, let's say.
Oh, like embedded in the police department. Okay,
and you roll up on something like George Floyd, and you're like, you're stepping on that guy's neck, right?
Oh, I think that's a brilliant idea. Long,
get off his neck
right
now.
Because, look, the problem with a lot of PDs is they succumb to groupthink, right?
Yeah.
Because it's all very insular, protect our own. We've always done it this way. So, yeah, if you have that outsider perspective, like you do in any enterprise or business, there are benefits to having somebody from the outside in there.
And have you ever been under like so much stress or so scared or so anxious that you've lost track of time?
Absolutely. I have. Many times.
I would imagine if we get into a rolling fight with a 6'4 dude and then, you know, we have to pin him down to the ground, the adrenaline's pumping pretty hard. I may not realize I've been standing on the guy for 5 minutes.
Right.
Maybe one idea is just take people who are not trained as police at all. Just have them show up and say, wow, that just really looks bad too. Stop stepping on that guy.
Yeah, I think that's a super positive idea. I think it would be great to see
or,
that.
Hey, you three other officers that are sitting there on tape shouting out stuff like, this is what happens when you do drugs. Why don't you three go sit in the car? I think this guy's good. I have no hope that anything significantly changes, but
positive as always, right?
Let's change topics.
Well, I did want to just quickly pivot back to the New York election. So it'll probably be weeks before we find out. That's not as much a reflection necessarily on ranked choice voting as it is
just New York
elections there. If you remember, every election, it tends to take weeks to count the vote in New York. And I don't know why that is.
And these are easy elections. These are one party elections.
Yes.
Did you see who the Republican nominee for?
Curtis Silva, Guardian Angels.
Guardian Angels.
Yeah.
Remember him from the 80s?
Yes.
Where they had the red berets on.
Then he became a fixture on Fox News. He was a Fox News contributor from the like late 90s to early 2000s on Hannity and all those shows. That's the Republican
nominee.
This is
what happens when crime gets out of control. You get independent citizens forming these groups that...
You do.
I don't know if the Guardian Angels did anything good, anything bad, but just coming from a Midwesterner looking at them, that looked a little... little sketchy from my perspective.
I mean, getting a little bit too close to like militias.
Yeah.
I will say after this New York election, we will have another test case in ranked choice voting, and that will be, well, there might be more this year, but on a statewide basis, Alaska next year, because Alaska for their Senate race, so that's going to be ranked choice voting. And the way that's going to be done is instead of having party primaries, they're going to have one universal primary. All Democrats, all Republicans run together. And then the top four vote getters advance to the general election. And then in the general election, it's going to be ranked choice voting to determine the winner. So it'll be the same thing. So the fourth person in that election will drop off. They'll look at their second choice, apply those votes, and so on. So that'll be fascinating.
Maybe just say Murkowski. Yeah.
I think that will be the saving grace, because I think absent of that, if she was running a traditional Republican primary, I don't think she'd be able to pull it off.
I don't. It's certainly going to help her.
Yeah.
And you know Trump is going to go to Alaska.
Oh, he's already said. And he already has a person who's running against her who's, So
I want to pivot to spend the last 10 minutes talking about the NCAA and the Supreme Court, because that
momentous decision
that's just
going to
feel, that's just going to feel good. So before we get to the decision, if there's one group that needs to be level set, if there's one group of people that think that they have some sort of moral high ground, it's the NCAA. And they have touted the virtues of amateur athleticism since they've been created.
Yeah.
I am so glad that the Supreme Court finally looked at them and said, you're not better, you're not right, you've done this completely wrong, and you're going to change. And if you don't change, the next time you get back here, we're gonna put a whammy on you today. We're gonna really get you if we see you back here. And I think that was long, long, long overdue.
Yeah, and talk about a death blow. A unanimous decision on this, too. And this, as was said prior, this was a case that the NCAA brought on and requested the Supreme Court weigh in.
So basically, if you don't follow sports a lot, the college athletics has been a shit show of hypocrisy since it was created.
Yeah.
If you don't know, and I mean, even casual non-sport fans know that college athletics generates a gazillion dollars, and that the kids, the athletes, they really don't get paid anything from a salary or any monetary basis. And what this suit said, the Supreme Court said, it is now acceptable for the schools to offer additional education benefits more than just the scholarship for playing a sport. So, for example, the college can supply you with better laptops, better lodging. Would you like an internship over the summer? If you couple this with, I think there's 13 states that have already passed these laws where they can monetize their own image, college sports is going to look very, very different moving forward.
And it's great. These are kids that are working hard. Yes. They're not allowed to monetize their work and their performance at all. And a lot of this money just gets pocketed by the NCAA, and a lot of it ends up going to excesses elsewhere. Like, I mean, there's plenty of stories, UCLA, that these fancy locker rooms that they spend millions of dollars on. I mean,
LSU looks like a freaking spaceship.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people get that the big football program, they're going to get theirs.
Right.
There's so much money. What I'm happy for, where I think this helps, think of the Parkville University girls volleyball team.
Right. Women's basketball.
Yeah. Now, they could go to like a car dealership over the summer, put like on a little clinic there where they hit the volleyball around. They talk to your kids about volleyball and going to college while you work out your deal with the dealership. And they pay the team $2,000. The girls all pocket, $150 each, and it's a good day.
Yeah.
That's why not do that?
I mean, it's just crazy to me that this has not been allowed for as long as it has.
What I love is that, and this is Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh wrote the majority opinion on this and just laid into them. What I really enjoy about this is finally somebody with the authorities looked at the NCAA and said, just because you call these kids amateurs doesn't excuse you from antitrust and employment law, which is basically what you've been doing. And I really like that they got it handed to them, because their main defense was, this is how it's always been done. And just for anybody who's stuck in that thought pattern, they just made it very clear. You just don't get to decide, Brandon, we're in business, I pay you. Suddenly I come up one day and say, Brandon, I've reclassified your job as an amateur. You get four Taco Bell gift certificates and this parting gift as pay. I am so glad that finally somebody looked at them and said, take this cloak of purity that you've tried to wear. Screw that. You're not that. You've never been that, or you haven't been that for a very long time. This is the change.
It's all been an image they've struggled to maintain, and it's been difficult for them to maintain, especially over the last several years, as more of these scandals have emerged.
Yes. And the NCAA is just, if you want to look at hypocrisy and how an organization loses its own members and alienates the people that it's tried to make fans, well, the NCAA is a classic case study on that.
Right.
And this brings me to there are three terrible fan bases in the Midwest. This is Craig talking. I don't want to associate Brandon with this because first, KU basketball. Second, St. Louis Cardinals baseball. Third, Nebraska football.
I'm going to let you own all of that. That is Craig words and not mine.
These are the three worst fan bases in the Midwest because they're all the same. Because they just do it differently, Brandon. You know, you've hung around a lot of KU people.
You know, I have.
They just do it different. It just means more, right? It's football in Nebraska. You know, that stadium's our third. It just means more to us, right? Well, no, you're going to see all of that melt away. And you're seeing it first with Nebraska. Nebraska has one of those state laws that says you can monetize your thing. I don't think it kicks in till January 2023.
Oh, okay.
Brandon, July 1, they're having a seminar for their athletes about how the school is going to help them monetize their image and how they can use being a football player at the University of Nebraska to make money. That's how special Nebraska thinks amateurism is. My point here, and the reason for all the sarcasm, this has all been a hypocritical joke from day one. It's about one thing: money and winning.
Yep.
Period. Nobody gives a shit about these kids, and I'm just glad now that if you're a football player, you can make money on the side. I think the next step that's coming is they should offer you health insurance.
Yeah.
If you get hurt, you should be able to go on disability.
Benefits.
This is your job.
Right.
By Kavanaugh said it too. By any definition, these kids work for you.
Yeah.
So that to me just feels like for my whole life, that feels like a 50-year injustice that's finally going to get unpacked.
Finally being remedied. That's good to see.
But I hate the schools. Let me just kick Nebraska in the nuts one last time.
Apparently you can't say that enough.
The reason I despise Nebraska, they still think they're relevant, which is so cute. But that's what gets me with Nebraska.
Fans riled up with this.
It means so much, and it's so special. To my knowledge, you're the first college that's coming out strong saying, we will help you make money off this school. That to me is just finally admitting it's always been a rigged game. We're just going to, okay, screw it. There it is. Yeah. Let's just come here and make some money.
Right.
Amateur athletes don't exist. They shouldn't exist. We should just all wash that out of our minds.
Agreed.
Well, Creighton, their basketball team, there's going to be some kids, I think, in Des Moines get a pretty sweet college internship in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So, yeah.
And are you offended by that anyway?
No.
Not at all. Is?
Why would anybody be? That's what I don't understand. I don't understand that mentality of people that take offense at that or feel like it, you know, diminishes the reputation of the school or the program. How so? I don't get it.
There's so much about America that's just a business. I've never understood why college athletic. Here's what really gets me: how you can be watching, you know, like a college game day show, you know, on ESPN or something, and they'll be talking about, you know, athleticism and amateurism and all of that, and it's the purity of the sport. That position has slid a lot in the last couple of years, but you still get people that do that. And then they'll turn right around and show you the betting line on the game. Wait a minute.
Hello.
You just told me this was like for purity and for pride in school and for fun. Why are you sponsored by DraftKings and you keep flashing me the line?
Right.
I'm just hoping it's one last bastion of hypocrisy that dies in America.
Agreed. And like we said, it's one that's been a long time coming.
Yeah. I don't know how they've skated by this long. And if they hadn't called for this judgment, would they have ever been checked like this?
No.
Eventually somebody would have brought a case that did something, but the political interesting point in this is once again, with this session of the Supreme Court, it proves you can be appointed by a conservative Republican it doesn't mean you're going to just go down the lever voting.
No, and I think out of all of the institutions in society, the Supreme Court has shown that it's the most independent, and it doesn't reflect the intense polarization you see in all the other two branches. We've seen that in case after case. We saw the case that upheld Obamacare and resisted that, you know, striking that down. There were only two justices that voted for that.
And they didn't agree with the case. They just felt like it had standing and could go forward.
And the other justices agreed, said there was no standing. So I think it's very interesting that we're seeing, and there's more and more speculation that the three, that the justices to now always watch are going to be Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, that they are the three because they're not completely 100% doctrinaire conservative. They're not like Thomas and Alito, and Thomas and Alito tend to be the far, far right on the court, and you all kind of always know where they're going to go. So those are the three to watch from decision to decision.
So one of the complaints about Roberts is that he narrows the scope of what they decide intentionally to gain consensus.
Yeah.
Is a narrow scope 8-1 better than a wider reaching 5-4?
It depends, right? So it depends on the case and the impact. But no, I think there's definitely downsides to that, because I think when you have the scope so narrow, all that does is ensure there's going to be related cases that come back to the court that are just going to be slightly different that the court is going to have to rule on. And so it ensures that there is more litigation, there is more confusion in some cases, where if they broaden the scope, it enables far-reaching decisions that are going to have greater impact and keep litigation at bay. So that's a problem. It's going to create more, not less litigation.
And a lot of conservatives hate the fact that he's doing that.
Yeah.
They want these broader decisions that touch more areas, are more kind of transformative. And that's what they're not getting out of Roberts.
No, but on the pro side, it also, in some ways, it ensures if you're someone of the liberal persuasion that some of these cases, it's good that they don't have far-reaching impact, right? So by limiting the scope, it ensures that your cause lives on to fight another day as well. So again, there's pros and cons on either side too.
Is anything going to come out of Biden? I just remembered his 90-day study of packing the court. Remember that?
That's right. I never was there anything. I don't recall anything being released.
It feels like that issue's dead already.
Yeah.
Do we really need that?
I don't see any momentum right now behind
there
that.
There seems to be absolutely no appetite for that right now. I mean, if Biden pulls off this infrastructure deal, I would say his first year has been about as expected. He's been there about 6 months. If in September they get this, I would say getting about what we expected.
Between the COVID relief bill and the infrastructure bill, I mean, he can establish himself as the president who saved the economy, brought us out of the pandemic, and then also was the one who was finally able to tackle our infrastructure needs.
And just from sheer politics now, playing the role of the Democratic consultant, get all the Dems together and say, we got to get these bills passed and we got to get them done before 2010.
Absolutely.
Because at 2010, we got to pivot to figuring out who is going to run for president, because it's not this guy. So
wait, 2010, you mean 20?
I'm sorry. Why do I have 2010 on my brain? We got to figure out for 2024 who's running, because it ain't this guy.
Right.
There's no way. So we got until 2022 to pass legislation. And then everybody's got to pivot to, if it's not Kamala Harris,
who is it?
Who is it? What's the process for removing? Can the vice president be fired by the president?
That's a good question. I don't know what.
Boy, that would be running some risky water.
Yeah. Because I don't recall that's ever been done before. I don't know.
If
that'd be something to look into.
If Kamala Harris comes out in 2022, because she's going to have to announce in the midterms, that's going to be really interesting to see how that goes down.
Well, and again, if she is going to run and she's going to be viable, I mean, she still has time, but she has to get her act together.
She's got to do better.
You know, that there's got to be. And, you know, regardless, and I've heard a lot of speculation on this, that she has bad staff. Well, if you have bad staff,
fire them.
And you get new staff.
That's right.
Like, you're the decision maker.
That's a you problem.
That's a you problem. Yeah, you have to be the one to step in and take charge.
And why don't you round round up all your cousins and nieces and nephews and tell them, they keep your ass off social media, yeah, and you're not going to make any money off me now. So just knock that shit off.
Yeah.
Brandon, I saw a movie in the theater for the first time.
Yes, this past Sunday, right? Father's Day.
My wife and I worked this out. We think 2018.
Wait, but that long? You didn't see any movies in 2019?
No, I'm sorry. New Year's Eve,
okay,
2019, we saw The Mule.
Wait, you didn't see any other movies throughout the rest of 2019?
Now, when did the Avengers stuff come out? I got to look that up because I saw both the Infinity and...
One of them came out in May 2019.
Okay, then those would have been the last ones I saw then. Yeah, for my wife, it was The Mule in 2019 because she wouldn't go see an Avengers movie.
Okay.
But it had been a long time.
Wow.
And we went and saw A Quiet Place 2.
Yes.
Which is a weird movie because there's not a lot of dialogue.
No, but at the same time, it's one of those movies you want to see in a theater, right? Because there's so much suspense that's built on the lack of sound, and then when there is sound. So a theater is a perfect place with surround sound to see that, especially if you see it in Dolby. I don't know if you saw it in the Dolby.
I was amazed how quiet people were.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good movie. The first
movie.
Quiet Place is pretty good. Quiet Place 2, I like that. So
they're both done. Do you know that, I'm forgetting her name, the actress right now, I'm blanking out.
Emily Blunt.
Emily Blunt. So her husband, John Krasinski from The Office was the executive director. Yeah. So that scene where she was in the van and she's going in reverse, you know, or in the car with the kids near the beginning, with the bus that's barreling towards her. So she shot that herself. There was no stunt double and she shot that in one take. And her husband kind of insisted that she do that. And she was like terrified. So when you see the terror on her face,
that's
like it's
real
because she was like thinking, oh my gosh, I could really get hurt. And she actually did get slightly injured, like doing that. So that scene, that's all real in terms of what happened, which is kind of interesting.
So the first Quiet Place has two scenes in it that just make me literally want to jump out of my skin. One is when she's walking down the stairs and she steps on the nail.
Yes, yes.
And it goes all the way. I had to hide behind pillows. I can't watch that. And secondly, when she has the baby, to think of a woman having a baby by herself in a bathtub, not making a sound.
That
was another one of those scenes of like, I think I need to like look at an angle at this.
That
or
is
something.
Too uncomfortable. Yeah, you're right. Those were two very uncomfortable scenes. So I saw the new Conjuring movie this past Sunday.
Scary movies seem to be making a comeback.
They are. Yeah. And I mean, I'm a fan of the Conjuring films, not so much the spinoffs in the Conjuring universe, but I like the original. This is the third Conjuring and I guess you would call the canon of the actual sequential Conjuring films. And it was very well done. So glad to see that. But something that I caught on HBO Max, because I bought HBO Max.
Is something good finally on HBO Max?
Well, I only bought HBO Max originally because I have too many streaming channels to see the Friends reunion special, which I really want to see.
Yeah.
I wanted to watch, I saw the show that actually premiered, it's a 6-episode series that premiered last October on HBO Max called The Undoing. Did you see that one?
I've not seen that.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. So it's Hugh Grant, Nicole Kidman.
Okay.
And it's suspenseful melodrama thriller, crime thriller about this family that lives in Manhattan's Upper East Side. I won't tell you what happens, but there's a crime, a murder committed, their lives unravel, and it keeps you guessing from episode to episode, and you think you have it figured out, and then something else happens. You're like, wait a second. And then like each of the characters has flaws and is imperfect, and you start like wondering like, you know, who's telling the truth here. And it's been a long time since I've seen a series where every episode has almost like a mini cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And so you immediately want to start episode.
Yeah.
So highly recommend. It's only 6 episodes. If
so you
want to check
power
it out
through that. Pretty
yeah.
Quickly.
You can power through it. And it's so suspenseful. I mean, it is not slow at all.
Is CBS All Access and Paramount Plus now the same thing?
I think so.
Okay.
I read something about that. Yeah, that they
combined. I bought
combined.
CBS
yeah.
Plus specifically for the Star Trek content.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And now Picard's coming out with a new season, but it says on Paramount Plus.
Yeah.
So it's like, damn it. I got to get that? And
So they're both owned by Viacom. Like they're both under the same parent company.
Do you have to buy them separately?
I don't know. That's a good question. I need to look into that because there was something I was looking for the other day that's coming out, and it's only coming to Paramount Plus, and so I'll have to.
Yeah, they kind of snuck that one in there.
Yeah.
Because it used to be like Yellowstone was on Paramount.
Right. That's
now
right.
Now it's on Paramount Plus, which I guess you got to pay for.
Right. And that's another one I've wanted to see, but I don't have Paramount Plus, and I haven't pulled the trigger on getting that because I'm kind of like maxed out. I have like five or six streaming channels, and it's like, how many do you keep adding?
One thing.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm like, this Apple thing, Joe, do we got to get that? She's like, Ted Lasso comes out next month. We got to watch that. I'm like, all right, I guess if we got to, we got to.
And what's the other one I liked on the
morning
news
show?
The morning show. Yeah. Yes. That's the other one on Apple that's really good. I saw the first season and wanted to see season two. Yeah.
Yeah. We have many $12 to $15 streaming services that we've bought for one damn.
That's the problem,
thing,
right?
That and we then can't it just, give it up.
Yeah.
You do anything else fun or exciting or?
Lately, not too much. I was spending time outside until it got super hot. So
God, it's been just disgusting here.
Yeah. Today
I think,
was.
I think it's supposed to rain tonight, but.
Supposed to get some pretty heavy storms, possible tornadoes. Midwestern living.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.